Welcome to the Liver Lounge, your go-to podcast for the latest updates in hepatology, featuring discussions with the world's leading experts.
Hi everyone, thanks for tuning in to this latest podcast by the Liver Foundation. I'm Margaret, I'm from the National University Health System in Singapore, and really honored to have with me today Professor Juan Pablo Arab. He's an assistant professor of medicine, and he's from the Western University in Ontario, Canada. So welcome, Dr. Arab, and thanks for agreeing to this discussion. We will be discussing your article today. I think you authored this article entitled "New Insights into the Molecular Basis of Alcohol Abstinence and Relapse in Alcohol-Associated Liver Disease." So thanks, Dr. Arab, once again for agreeing to discuss this very important issue with us.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Margaret, and thanks everyone that is connected today, listen to this podcast.
Great. So I think to start off, as a background, perhaps, Dr. Arab, you could comment on the importance of alcohol abstinence in alcohol-associated liver disease, or ALD for short. What are some of the clinical outcomes that we can, anticipate if the patient is able to achieve alcohol abstinence, and what's the projected impact of this on society in general?
So that's a great question, and I think that's the key question, actually. So alcohol abstinence, we know that is the most important therapeutic measure that we can take in patients with ALD. So we have, for example, data coming from studies on patients recovering from severe alcohol-associated hepatitis, which is the acute inflammatory form that has a very high mortality, up to 50% at 3 months. We know that most of the intervention that we do for severe alcohol-associated hepatitis are only effective at 1 month or even 3 months. But after that, the most important a prognostic factor is if the patient is able or not to achieve abstinence. It's also the fibrosis progression or the fibrosis status, if the patient is cirrhotic or not. So both are the most important predictor factors, because no matter what we do, if the patient keeps drinking, the disease is going to progress. So achieving abstinence is key. So we need to remember that every time that we have a patient with alcohol-associated liver disease, we actually have a patient who has two disease processes ongoing. One is the ALD, the alcohol-associated liver disease, and most likely also that patient has an alcohol use disorder, which is the psychiatric or mental disease that is associated with the lack of control and with the continued drinking despite having health consequences. So we know that in patients with severe ALHEP, abstinence is the most important predictor factor, but also abstinence is very important in patients without ALHEP and patients with ALD, because it's the main driver of liver disease progression, fibrosis progression, and decompensation. To give you an idea, so a patient without fibrosis, so F0, F1, that is drinking heavily, it may have a liver decompensation at 5 years in something around 2 to 5%, which is less than 1%, for example, in patients with MASLD. And if the patient has F4 fibrosis and keeps drinking, the risk of decompensation at 5 years is between 15 and 50%. So up to half of them can have a decompensated event. So actually, alcohol abstinence is probably the key player in patients with ALD.
That's a really wonderful answer, and a great way to introduce this theme of alcohol abstinence. And going back, I think you alluded to the fact that treatment of these patients with ALD, often we are treating more than one disease. We need to treat both the alcohol use disorder aspect of it, as well as the alcohol-associated liver disease aspect of it. So just wanted to touch on a bit about the pathophysiology underpinning AUD and ALD. Could you please comment a bit about that? I think you wrote a short and very nice section on that in the review as well.
So basically, when you have alcohol-related liver disease, and particularly in the more inflammatory forms in alcohol-associated hepatitis, there is probably three main pathophysiological processes that are happening. One is the ongoing injury over the hepatocytes with inflammation, necrosis, and remodeling, and at the end, fibrosis. So that's one. Number two is the what we call the gut-liver axis. So the alcohol itself, it's going to generate some gut barrier disruption that is going to lead to translocation of bacteria and bacterial products to the portal vein that at the end are going to end up in the liver, generating more inflammation and more damage. So, and the third process is the impaired regeneration. And this is especially true for alcohol-associated hepatitis. So that's why some of these patients may present even similar to an acute liver failure or acute on chronic liver failure, because there is some of these process. Similar processes are happening also in the brain. So the alcohol at the same time is also affecting the brain. There is all these inflammatory molecules around. There is all these bacterial products that are going to generate neuroinflammation. So also disruption of the hematoencephalic barrier, neuroinflammation, and the alcohol itself is going to affect the supporting cells other than the neurons, so the glia and astroglia. So all those cells are also going to be affected by the alcohol itself and by the inflammatory molecules that are working around.
Great. So I think you mentioned, you touched briefly on the gut-liver axis, or rather also I think we know as a gut-liver-brain axis. So the gut microbiome, I think you mentioned that it affects, that it has many effects on the liver and also on the neurobiology. Perhaps you could expound a bit on how these changes are actually associated with, alcohol, the damage related to alcohol-associated liver disease, and how does this make alcohol abstinence? I mean, we know alcohol abstinence is, really difficult to achieve, right? And for the patients who even manage to achieve it, there's high risk of relapse. So how do these gut-liver-brain axis and gut microbiome, how does that affect the ability to achieve abstinence as well as to sustain alcohol abstinence?
Yes, that's a great question. So how microbiome affect the gut-liver-brain axis? So actually, we have some interesting data in that sense. The initial data was showing that doing fecal microbiota transplantation in patients with ALD specifically with severe ALHEP led to better outcomes. So these studies came from Asia, from India, and those were the first studies. We don't know very well how that works or what are the individual components of that fecal microbiota transplantation leading to improvement in liver outcomes. But the data was pretty strong showing that it helps. Most recently, Jas Bajaj from BCU showed that if you do FMT in patients with ALD, it not only helps the liver, but also it may reduce the craving. So help with the AUD part of the disease. So again, that showed that microbiota is not only involved in the liver, and that can be explained by the inflammation, but probably treating the inflammation and treating the all disease biosis and translocation of bacteria and bacterial products is also helping at the brain level. And a more targeted approach was taken by Werner Schnabel at UCSD, where they identify a bacteria in the microbiota, an Enterococcus faecalis producing cytolysin that was associated with poor outcomes in patients with severe ALHEP. And basically targeting those bacteria using phage technology, they were able to destroy those Enterococcus faecalis producing cytolysin. And that seems to ameliorate the liver injury. So again, that's a proof of concept that some of these relationships and treatments, although it's not very clear, it's not very straightforward, because you may say, okay, if the microbiota is an issue, we should use prophylactic antibiotics, for example, in patients with severe HEP. But recently was published the anti-VOCore trial from the French group, where they used augmenting for patient as a prophylaxis for patient with severe HEP, and did not show any improvement of the gut liver brain axis that is interacting, the importance of microbiota. But still, we have work to do on better understanding how this works and how we can intervene to improve outcomes.
So I think thanks a lot for that wonderful answer. So I think gut microbiome, obviously, it's emerging and looks like it's going to be a very important aspect of care for these patients with ALD or AUD. I think the other thing that was mentioned is the role of the immune system, right? Because I think alcohol obviously has numerous effects on the immune system. And I think maybe perhaps, Dr. Arab, you could take us through some of the key pointers in terms of what should we expect in terms of possible therapeutic targets in the immune system for treatment of patients with AUD or ALD.
Yeah, this is another very important topic, and probably it's very complex still for us to understand what is happening, but actually, chronic alcohol consumption is going to generate some immune paresis. So the immune system is not that active. And that's why many of these patients are getting chronic infections and pneumonia or SVP or, you know, urinary tract infections. But on the other side, at some point, the alcohol is going to activate the immune system. And that's the rationale or behind, you know, an episode of severe alcohol-associated hepatitis. It's an uncontrolled inflammation that is basically driven by the infiltration of immune cells to the liver that are going to, you know, release some substance, including cytokines, but also extracellular vesicles and reactive oxygen species that are going to generate like a cascade of more inflammation down the road, and this is called systemic inflammatory response syndrome. So all of these, I mean, all this inflammation and cytokine storm is going to generate more apoptosis, more necrosis, not only in the liver, the same, you know, cytokines are going to the brain to generate more neuroinflammation. And the liver part is basically all these molecules are going to activate some of the cells, including the hepatic stellate cells that are the cells that produce the extracellular matrix. And at the end, it's fibrosis and can lead to cirrhosis. So it's basically a self-perpetuating cycle that is happening not only in the liver, we know, but it's going to happen in the gut and also in the brain that leads to more disease. Unfortunately, some of the drugs trying to aim directly to treat only, you know, the inflammation, like, you know, IL-1 or some of these cytokines, have not been effective on improving outcomes. It's because probably the pathophysiology is much more complex than only that. But again, I think inflammation is one of the important pathophysiological pathways in ALD that we should treat. But it's not the only one that should be treated.
Thanks a lot. I think that this was actually a very nice kind of summary and gives us a good picture on how alcohol actually affects the immune system. Just wanted to kind of ask and move on a bit. I think in your review, it was also mentioned about some of the other potential novel therapeutic targets. And I think of interest to many hepatologists would be some things that you mentioned. So these are like old drugs that we could repurpose for new indications. So I think the two things that kind of jumped out to me was number one, GLP-1 receptor agonist. I think that's something that's really gained a lot of traction in recent years, especially in the muscle space. And that, and also spironolactone, which we also use for patients with ascites. So perhaps Dr. Arab, maybe you could kind of take us through some of the background into how these were identified as possible therapeutic targets for AUD or ALD, and also what do you think, you know, these will turn out to be like in future? Are these ready for usage, or how much more do we have to do in terms of research, or how far do we have to go before these are ready?
Yeah, no, those are great questions. And actually, I will say that, you know, so we need more drugs and we need to treat AUD. I told you that when we have a patient with ALD, we always have a patient with actually two diseases. So we have ALD and AUD, and we need to treat both. And we are usually not doing it. So we need new drugs. We need better drugs. And there where there is some potential treatments, where, for example, you mentioned GLP-1. So GLP-1 is very broadly used now for obesity, for type 2 diabetes mellitus, and also now for MASLD. But it has been shown that reduce the craving. So there is some initial data that shows that reduce the initial craving. That craving can be also for food, right? But in this case, it seems that also reduce the craving for alcohols in heavy alcohol drinkers. So it may be a good opportunity to treat the craving, especially in those patients that has an overlap between MASLD and ALD that is now called MET-ALD, the new entity. So for MET-ALD, it could be a good potential intervention. All those trials are already ongoing. So that's one. Regarding spironolactone, it's very attractive because we use it very frequently in a patient with liver disease. These are pharmacoepidemiology studies, so these are not a randomized controlled trials, very strong evidence. But it has shown that patients that use spironolactone tend to drink less than patients that are not on spironolactone. We need further studies, probably randomized controlled trials, or at least, you know, real world evidence to support the use of spironolactone. But I will say that we still have some medications. We have baclofen, acamprosate, naltrexone, gabapentin. All of those are used in general for alcohol use disorder, not particularly in ALD, but more data is coming that those are safe and can be used. But the problem is we as hepatology providers are doing a poor job. So if you review the data, there is a nice paper showing a cohort from the Veterans Affairs, from the VA, from the US, with close to 40,000 patients with cirrhosis due to ALD. And that paper showed that only 1.4% of those patients are being treated with either pharmacotherapy or behavioral therapy. So if we are treating 1% of our patients for AUD, we cannot expect good outcomes, right? So basically, we are setting up patients for failure if we don't provide treatment properly. So again, that my call is we as a hepatology provider should be treat on some basics or of addiction medicine and start prescribing to these patients. Because if we are waiting that everyone is seen by an addiction psychiatrist, that is difficult, right? And we see this patient very often in our clinic. So at least, you know, in the Americas, 60% of the attributable fraction of cirrhosis is due to ALD. So I agree, we need new therapies, but also we need to start using systematically what we have already available.
Well, that's a really, really good kind of insight. I think the message that you wanted to let our listeners know is that we already have therapies available, but it's being underused, although we are also you know, looking at newer therapies. So can I just ask, you know, in your own clinical practice, you mentioned that you do give some of these medications like acamprosate, naltrexone. How about the group of patients with decompensated disease? I think quite a lot of these medications are contraindicated in this group of patients. What do you then propose that we should do for them?
So that's a good question. And then usually when I have a patient like that, I need to ask some additional questions. Regarding drugs specifically, we know that disulfiram is particularly contraindicated in especially with advanced liver disease. I tend to not use it with any degree of liver disease. Baclofen is the only one that has an RCT showing safety, although now we have new data showing that acamprosate is safe. Just be careful when acamprosate, when patient has a renal dysfunction because he's metabolized and excreted by the kidney. And naltrexone used to have a black box warning from the FDA, but that was removed. And actually, during the last liver meeting in Boston, was presented data showing that naltrexone is safe in patients with cirrhosis, not decompensated cirrhosis. In decompensated cirrhosis, I would say that the key follow-up question is if this patient is a transplant candidate or not. If you have a decompensated patient with ALD, you should question if the patient is a transplant candidate. If the patient is a transplant candidate and is able to engage on relapse prevention program and behavioral therapy, probably that will be preferred, and you can start pharmacotherapy post-transplant. If the patient is not a liver transplant candidate, usually I try to engage them in relapse prevention program and behavioral therapy more than pharmacotherapy due to the side effects. You can try some, but some of the time these patients, you know, most of them will have or AKI or severe liver dysfunction, or sometimes, you know, the hepatic encephalopathy doesn't allow you to treat properly. And those are probably the most challenging cases where we need new drugs.
Great. Well, that's a really good kind of tip. You know, like I think for us as hepatologists, when we deal with these patients, I think a lot of us are not yet comfortable to give medications to treat alcohol use disorder. And just in your practice, you mentioned that you do give these clinics these patients these medications. Would this be like in a co-located clinic with a psychiatrist or addiction medicine specialist? And how about those physicians with less resources available, like physicians practicing in non-transplant centers or who may not have access to these medications?
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I will say that everyone should be at least be doing brief interventions, and there is ways to be trained to do brief intervention and motivational interviewing. I mean, you can take courses in motivational interviewing, and it's helpful not only for alcohol, it's helpful for any lifestyle intervention that now we in hepatology clinics are seeing very often, you know, obesity, diabetes related to MASLD, or other lifestyle interventions that you can do. So I would say if you don't have much resources, brief interventions, motivational interviewing that they refer when possible, and then medications, it will depend on what you have available. I would say that at least here, even primary care have access to naltrexone, to gabapentin, to some of the medication that can be useful for this population.
Thanks a lot for your great answer on how to manage this increasingly prevalent condition. Before we, you know, kind of round off, I just wanted to ask if you have any other key points or key messages that you'd like to convey to the listeners of this podcast.
So I will say that the key message is that we need to recognize that every time that we face a patient with alcohol-related liver disease, we are also facing a patient that most likely is dealing with alcohol use disorder. Both carries a high stigma even today, and usually the patient and the family are not coming up front because of fear or previous experience. So we need to be very open that we are in a guilt-free environment, and what we want is to support the patient to do their best and to be abstinent and hopefully recover and not needing a transplant. If they need a transplant, we are going to be there to support them. But we need to also recognize that we are under-treating patients with AUD, and we need to early intervene, understanding that the same pathophysiology apply for ALD and AUD. New drugs are coming, and those that are kind of the exciting part for us, but we have still things available, and we can optimize what we are doing until we have new things coming to be available to use.
Well, so that's a really simple but a very great and effective message. So, and I think this concludes our discussion very nicely. So to all listeners, thanks for listening in, and we hope that this is helpful for your management of patients with AUD and ALD, and also really appreciate your time here, Dr. Arab, to convey your expertise in this subject matter to us and our listeners. So thanks a lot, Dr. Arab, once again.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
We have come to the end of the episode. Thank you for joining us, and stay tuned for more captivating discussions.